Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Spencer of the International Rescue Committee, who discusses violence against women in Congo and her group's grassroots programs that have been developed to protect and empower them. Rebecca Jeschke of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains her group's demand for information on lobbyists who work to secure retroactive immunity for telecommunication companies engaged in warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. And Justine Sharrock, author of the article Age of Treason, who examines the new right-wing group Oath Keepers, made up of active-duty U.S. soldiers and others who pledge to disobey what they consider unconstitutional orders. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The police chief of Dubai, Lieutenant General Dahi Khalfan Tamim, has tied Israel's spy agency, Mossad, to the assassination of a prominent Hamas leader in a Dubai hotel in mid-January. According to the Guardian newspaper, Dubai initially identified an 11-person hit team which arrived in the city with forged or stolen European passports and, within hours, killed the Hamas leader in his hotel room and then left the country. Mahmoud al-Mabou, the founder of the military wing of Hamas, was wanted by Israel for the abduction and killing of two Israeli soldiers in 1989. More recently, he had handled arms sales and logistics with Iran. The assassination was similar to a 1997 Mossad murder attempt on then-Hamas leader Khaled Mashal using doctored Canadian passports. More recently, two suspected Israeli agents were convicted in 2005 in New Zealand for carrying forged passports. The investigative news service ProPublica reports the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is gearing up for a fight with the Obama administration over workplace safety rules on musculoskeletal disorders like carpal tunnel syndrome. The chamber held a closed-door strategy meeting in January to oppose a new reporting requirement by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, that asks about musculoskeletal injuries on workplace surveys. The business lobby fears the Obama administration is using the OSHA reporting requirement as a first step in an attempt to issue broad new regulations on workplace ergonomics. In the last days of the Clinton administration, OSHA issued 1,600 pages of rules on ergonomics that took 3 years to draft. In a heated reply, business lobbyists pressured the Republican-controlled Congress to nullify the regulations by activating the Congressional Review Act. The current OSHA reporting proposal is based on data collected over the last 5 years by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that show that muscle and bone conditions account for a third of all workplace injuries. After the Democrats took control of both houses of Congress, the Chamber of Commerce feared a revival of the Clinton-era ergonomics rule. Conservative critics of President Obama include the birthers, who claim the president is not a naturally born citizen and consequently is not eligible to be president. The same band of right-wingers calling themselves the Eligibility Movement has now set its sights on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In January of 2009, Foreign Service officer David Rodiermal sued Hillary Clinton in federal court, citing an obscure section of the U.S. Constitution preventing her from becoming Secretary of State. The reason was, as U.S. Senator, Clinton voted for pay raises for the Secretary's office. Rodiermal based his case on the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution, which bars members of Congress from filling a federal job if Congress acted to raise the pay of that position while the appointee was a federal legislator. Presidents since Richard Nixon have gotten around this clause by repealing specific pay raises for the position in question. According to Mother Jones magazine, the plaintiff, Rodiermal, is a hardcore conservative who in 2004 donated $250 to Swiftboat Veterans for Truth and has supported Judicial Watch in several lawsuits against Bill and Hillary Clinton. The federal district court in Washington, D.C. threw out the lawsuit, saying Rodiermal lacked standing to bring the case. Yet the conservative activist has an opportunity to appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Since 1994, violence has raged in the Democratic Republic of Congo as armies and irregular forces from within the country and from many of the 9 surrounding nations have fought over territory and the nation's enormous mineral wealth. An estimated 5 million people have died as a result of war, illness, or starvation since 1988. In recent years, the violence in Congo has been concentrated in the eastern provinces of North Kivu and South Kivu near Rwanda. Violence against women has been a hallmark of life there, and women are at risk for rape, dismemberment, and death as they go about the tasks of their daily lives. In the city of Bukavu, in South Kivu Province, the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, has been working with local organizations for 35 years to protect women from gender violence. This is the city that Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton visited recently to promote women's development and condemn violence against women. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Spencer from her office in the IRC compound of Bukavu, where she directs the IRC's programs in eastern Congo and where she has been based for the past 2 years. Spencer discusses the dangers women face in Congo and the grassroots programs that have been developed to protect and empower them.
Whether you're in the United States or in Congo, if you're a survivor of rape, you can receive medical treatment within 72 hours that will help reduce the likelihood of transmitting HIV, reduce and treat sexually transmitted infections, and prevent unwanted pregnancies. So the International Rescue Committee works with national partners to make sure that women can access these services safely and in a timely manner. And, you know, Congo, Eastern Congo, is an incredibly beautiful part of the world, but also incredibly rural in some places. So what we do is work with our partners to make sure that those services are available throughout all parts of North and South Kivu, which are 2 provinces in eastern Congo that have been plagued by civil war for over a decade. And we worked with our partners to make sure that women in very rural areas can access services locally and that they don't have to travel long distances to the provincial capitals to receive that treatment. Over the last several years, we've seen some parts of eastern Congo start to stabilize, some parts have deteriorated, and that cycle has continued over the last several years. While Congo hasn't featured in the news recently, the war is still continuing, and that's, you know, in part because the world has the international media and the world has been gripped with the tragedy in Haiti and focused on other crises and conflicts around the world. But unfortunately, though the international attention may have shifted a bit, the war is still going on. And the reality that every woman and girl faces in eastern Congo is that they wake up facing a risk that they may be the target of an assault or an attack. And that is a very real threat that, you know, all women and girls face in eastern Congo, whether they're going to their farms to harvest crops, whether they're going to the market to buy goods, or whether they're taking their children to school. It is a daily threat, and it's a very real threat that women and girls face.
Sarah Spencer, have you ever heard any explanation for the level of barbarity there by the different forces, that are the different armed actors, like boys forced to have sex with their mothers or cutting off and cooking someone's limbs and forcing family members to eat them?
When you're forcing family members to commit atrocities against their own family, you are breaking down societal norms and cultural mores and terrifying a population to bend to the will of the armed group that's controlling that portion of the country. So it is, in fact, a deliberate military strategy. And in some cases, armed groups are given carte blanche to carry out whatever they will against communities. So in fact, if you can imagine it, the actual military targets themselves are the communities and not necessarily another armed group. IRC, International Rescue Committee, has certainly seen that the levels of brutality against women and girls have increased over the last year and have issued some very strong statements about it. And we were alarmed to see receiving some stories and cases and noting this increase in brutality. And as a result, really working with some of the foreign governments that are working towards peace in eastern Congo and that are providing funding for humanitarian agencies to ensure that they're, you know, committed to a peaceful resolution to the conflict in eastern Congo and to ensure that civilian protection remains the number one priority for the peacekeeping, the UN peacekeeping mission in Congo, and that that's not overlooked for greater, you know, military objectives on the part of the international community or the United Nations.
I read a recent report that said worldwide, 40% of reported rapes are of girls 15 and under. I don't know how the age of the victim affects the reporting of the rape, but what do you see about the age of victims of sexual violence in Congo?
Between a quarter and a third of the people who are reporting are children, are under 18, and 80%, and in some places it's even higher, are reporting that their perpetrators are members of an armed group.
You work with local organizations there. What can you say about any progress that's been made in dealing with the issue of sexual violence?
What we've done is partnered with these organizations to really help them mobilize for change in the way in which women are viewed in Congo, and to help afford them other opportunities in terms of education, in terms of inheritance, and create a space where women can really enjoy their full rights. And, you know, these stories are actually the really heartening ones. And it's an example, and it should serve as an example to the international community that peace and stability also rests on the shoulders of women. They are really the drivers for peace and security and prosperity in Eastern Congo.
That was Sarah Spencer of the International Rescue Committee. Contact the IRC at area code 212-551-3000 or visit their website at theirc.org. Congress passed the FISA Amendment Act of 2008 in June of that same year, which reformed the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The legislation, among other things, ordered lawsuits filed against telecommunications companies that engaged in government-ordered warrantless spying on American citizens to be dropped. The law also granted retroactive immunity from prosecution to these same companies. Although then-Senator Barack Obama had voiced opposition to warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens, he voted for the bill. Over the last several years, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, under the Freedom of Information Act, has been seeking the release of the identities of lobbyists working on behalf of telecommunications companies that pressured various government agencies and Congress to grant their clients immunity. On February 9th, a federal appeals court in San Francisco gave a boost to the lawsuit when it rejected the Obama administration's claim of lobbyist privacy to hide the identities of telecom industry lobbyists. In his ruling, Judge Michael Daley Hawkins said, quote, "There is a clear public interest in public knowledge of the methods through which well-connected corporate lobbyists wield their influence," end quote. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rebecca Jeschke, Media Relations Director with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains why her group is demanding information on telecom lobbyists and the current status of government spying on U.S. citizens.
As you may know, there has been a lot of back and forth with the government, with the courts, about how much information the public has a right to see, and we feel the right that the public deserves to know about what these corporations have done and did to influence the government, to advance their interests, and to protect them in court. Most recently, part of it went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, and the court ruled that there was a clear public interest in the public knowing the methods through which corporate lobbyists wield their influence over government. So that was good. The appeals court backed our push to get more disclosure. However, it also sent part of the case back down to the district court. This is how the court process goes, and asked the district court to consider some issues further, including how to release the identities of the lobbyists and if that would reveal state secrets somehow. So every time we get a ruling from a district court judge, the government tries to block. So that's why this is still ongoing.
What would happen if your group and others pursuing this case did get the identities revealed in court? What would be the next step then?
Well, we would use those identities to find out, you know, who they were working for, and to gather more information. We're not really interested in knowing, for example, it was Jane Doe per se. What we're interested in is what that says about what organizations they work for, what kinds of you know, payments they got to do the work that they did. It's that these names, as part of the communications that go back and forth, hold the key to more information that is much more relevant than their actual names, to the kinds of negotiations that went on during the FISA Amendments Act debate of 2008.
What aspect would that be important to know? Let's say you got some lobbyists, firms and actual individuals named, and you found out, for instance, that Sprint or AT&T or Verizon or whatever, these big companies were all lobbying the White House and Congress to get their retroactive immunity. What kinds of information would be important for the public to know about that process in terms of money that may have changed hands, contributions to various legislators on Capitol Hill or to presidential campaigns? I'd be curious to know about that. But is that the kind of logic that you're following?
Yes, and that's exactly where we'd start. Of course, is following the money, seeing what kind of money telecommunications companies paid to what lobbyists, who they contacted, what sort of money overlap there was in various parts of these interactions. But one of the interesting things about FOIA documents is that when you open them to the public, which is what we do. We, put them on the website and have people sort of, crowdsource it. Is that you often don't know what you're going to find, and there's surprises in there. And the more information, that's why you need all the information that's available to you by law, is because you sometimes don't know what kind of picture you're going to paint until you have all the data there in order to put it together.
President Obama, when he campaigned for the presidency, talked about how the country needed to return to the rule of law, which he charged his predecessor, George W. Bush, with tarnishing. The September 11th attacks justified a lot of abuses of power Barack Obama talked about. And as a professor of constitutional law, he discussed the need for government openness, transparency, contrasting himself with President Bush. It seems that the positions that Barack Obama has taken since he's become president really contradict his positions as a candidate.
That has been true in transparency issues. There have been some situations where he's been more transparent, and that's great, and we celebrate that. But unfortunately, a lot of our Freedom of Information Act cases, some of our other lawsuits involving the warrantless wiretapping, happening the AT&T, Juul v. NSA, those are cases against the government on a broader scale about the warrantless wiretapping. The Obama administration has basically mimicked the position of the Bush administration that these are state secrets and cases should not be litigated, and in some cases have gone even farther and made even more sweeping claims than the Bush administration.
What do we know right now about the surveillance programs begun by President George W. Bush? What is the status now of these massive internet as well as phone communication surveillance programs that recorded millions of calls or analyzed them for keywords or we don't know what? Is that still in play, or is that a mystery or a government secret at this point?
As you know, it's a secret that's not a secret. The Bush administration has basically acknowledged that it went on during the Bush administration, yet some parts of it are still a secret. Certainly, I would think that if the administration stopped these policies or changed them fundamentally, that they would crow about it to the American people, and that's certainly not something that we've seen happen. There were lots of physical structures that were put into place for this widespread surveillance. As you said, these dragnet surveillance of internet traffic, of emails, we have evidence of the specific secret room in San Francisco at AT&T that diverted all this internet traffic to the NSA. It would be hard to turn all that stuff off. Once something that big is moving, it's kind of hard to stop it.
That was Rebecca Jeschke, Media Relations Director with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at eff.org. With the election of America's first black president, white supremacist groups and right-wing organizations have seen a surge in membership. The Tea Party movement, whose members regularly accuse Barack Obama of being a non-citizen, Muslim, communist, out to destroy America, is an example of a newly energized set of extremist fringe groups that are on the rise around the nation. Extremist violence is also on the rise, such as the recent suicide plane attack on an IRS office in Austin, Texas, the murder of three police officers in Pittsburgh, the killing of a black security guard at the National Holocaust Museum, and the assassination of Kansas abortion provider Dr. George Tiller, all carried out by self-described right-wing activists. Into this highly charged environment, a new group emerged in early 2009, the Oath Keepers, founded by Yale-trained lawyer and former Ron Paul staffer Stuart Rhodes. Oath Keepers describes itself as a nonpartisan group of active duty and retired military and law enforcement personnel who pledge to disobey orders they believe are unconstitutional, including the imposition of martial law and, quote, the blockade of American cities, thus turning them into giant concentration camps, end quote. Although the group espouses nonviolence and claims not to be promoting the overthrow of the government, some of the group's members assert they are willing to take up arms against the federal government, which many believe is their sworn enemy. Since arriving on the scene, Oath Keepers have been promoted by many right-wing media pundits. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Justine Sharrock, author of the cover story in the March-April edition of Mother Jones magazine titled Age of Treason. Here, Sharrock describes her investigation into the Oath Keepers, profiling their members' beliefs and motivation, as well as the potential for violence she sees in this new so-called patriot group, with roots in the militia movement of the 1990s.
So the Oath Keepers are made up of policemen, firefighters, veterans, and current serving military. They're big thing is they are refusing to obey unconstitutional orders. So that can be anything from putting someone in a concentration camp or conducting a warrantless search. But then also some Oath Keepers have a more strict reading of the Constitution than a lot of people would. And so it sort of gets opened up to various interpretations of what the Constitution exactly is.
Now, what's the relationship with these members of the Oath Keepers to violence or potential violence?
Well, the official line of Oath Keepers is that they're nonviolent. And the idea is that if they were ordered to do something unconstitutional, they should lay down their weapons and refuse those orders. But there's also some discussion within the group of what would you do if someone else in your unit, for instance, were then to follow orders that you thought were unconstitutional? Would it be your job to stop them? How far would you go to stop them? Would you just argue with them, or would you, say, take up arms against them? The problem is that with the Oath Keepers, there's a large spectrum. Someone like Stuart Rhodes, who's the founder, very much preaches nonviolence. But then you have other individuals in the group who see the importance of protecting the country against the erosion of the Constitution as so important that they'd be willing, if pressed up against the wall, to take up arms to protect the citizens.
I was impressed by kind of the contradictory sentiments of these guys. In one way, they object to a lot of the extra-constitutional laws that were put in place under George W. Bush. But yet they didn't seem to become alarmed about these violations of civil liberties until Barack Obama became president. And maybe that's representative of a lot of these folks. Widespread government surveillance of U.S. citizens without court warrants, imprisoning U.S. citizens as enemy combatants, some of the other things you go into detail about in your article that I personally, and I know many people on the left, object to also. But again, it seemed like their concern really didn't kick in until Barack Obama became president. And they were okay with George Bush, initiating these extra-constitutional, historically anti-democratic measures.
Yeah, that's something I raised with them a lot because it does seem sort of hypocritical. And they acknowledge that a lot of the things that they are critical of and are protesting did start under Bush. But as some of them put it, they say that they trusted Bush to use those things against terrorists, for instance, not against themselves. And so when Obama was elected, they didn't trust him the same. For me, that seems somewhat of a weak argument. But the other element, I think, is that with the economic situation, politics started hitting closer to home and people started paying more attention. You might not like the Patriot Act, but you might not have that affect you on a daily basis very personally. But then if you lose your job and then you're seeing Wall Street getting bailed out, that is something where it hits you closer to home.
Now, I wanted to ask you a bit about the links of the Oath Keepers to the type of militia groups that developed and came to prominence in the 1990s, most infamously in the connections of Timothy McVeigh, who was a member of some of these militia organizations before he bombed the Oklahoma City federal building and killed hundreds of people. Are there connections that we should be concerned about with the Oath Keepers and these armed militia groups?
Well, there's a lot of similarity in the rhetoric. For instance, this year of the New World Order and this idea of martial law and the possibility of a tyrannical government. And there are some crossover, particularly with Richard Mack, who runs the No Sheriff Left Behind campaign, which the idea is to have sheriffs refuse to enact any federal laws. So there is some crossover there. One thing that's interesting with the Oath Keepers and compared to what was happening in the 90s is that they have a lot more reach on a mainstream level, both because of the internet and then also the sort of echo chamber that's set up with people like Glenn Beck. So that instead of just being fringe groups, they are reaching a wider audience, so it's larger numbers, but then also a more mainstream audience, which is giving them extra sense of legitimacy.
That was journalist Justine Sharrock, author of the Mother Jones magazine article, Age of Treason. Read the article online at motherjones.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.